Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rout, and to end the year, our last program for 2025, we've picked three of our favourite poets and short story writers, Eric Kennedy, Frankie McMillan, and Tusiata Avia.
Loneliness studies. If you're sad, go to a busy street and talk to some strangers. Now you're sad and getting suspicious looks. 12% of people have no close friends. A quarter of people read zero books in the last year. Connected phenomena, hard to judge, but it helps to have something wonderful to talk about. Get involved! Model planes, parkour, orchids, metal detecting, dogging, whatever. Even weird things are networking. You're almost never sorry you met someone, not really. Even the worst people, me, have something to offer pub quiz knowledge. Humans are the only animals that think they're not animals. Chatbot chimps programmed to miss each other and to miss missing each other.
Eric Kennedy, reading from his third poetry collection, Sick Power Trip. Eric is based in Otatahi and he is a lively and distinctive member of the literary community here. His first book, There's No Place Like the Internet in Springtime, was shortlisted for the Ockham Book Awards. And I always think of Mel Brooks when I read that title. You're looking surprised.
The most internet-y man alive, I guess. But, yeah, sure.
It's something to do with the springtime. It
was springtime for Hitler.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But moving on. You have such a clear and unmistakable voice, Eric, and every poem has something or many memorable lines or images or quotes that you could take from it. So I just wonder how you ended up deciding on Sick Power Trip as the title.
Well, it comes from a poem called, which I guess it has a memorable title, which is I Like Rich People, But I Couldn't Eat a Whole One Myself, which is a classic joke format thing. But like there it's used, I feel like, quite differently. It's like almost like a throwaway quip there, whereas as the book title, it became really sort of overdetermined in that, like, one of the things that the book deals with is chronic illness, specifically long COVID, which I feel like it's important to specify that and to, like, keep that in the discourse. So it's sick as in that, but it's also sick as in sort of like depraved. And then there's power as in ability or lack of ability, but also like hegemony, imperialism. And then trip as in sort of journey, but also reverie. And so like it's kind of dealing with a bunch of things like that. And as a title, it kind of works, although not as memorable to people, apparently, as There's No Place Like the Internet in Springtime, which everyone smiles at when they hear it. People are all, this is more of a puzzler, like it's like a problem to be worked out.
Yeah. It's but, got a kind of question at the end, isn't
but
it?
I think it applies, so I'm happy with it as a title.
When you put a collection together, obviously you are busy producing poems all your life. There's not, I can't imagine there's a time when you haven't got a poem on the go or
relatively reliable. Like that,
yes.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean to say you're an automaton spitting out poems, but.
No, there are lots of bad poems too.
Oh, well, for every good poem, there must be a few.
I don't know. I don't know if we should even say how many bad there are.
No. Let's not get into the ratio of good to bad. But are you aware that you're generating a collection or what?
This time more than the two previous times. which I don't think is, like, atypical. I think oftentimes your first book is just, like, the best of what you've done. Some people come out of the gate with, like, something incredibly organized and coherent and wonderful. And that wasn't me. My first book's sort of interesting, but it's not, it didn't have a kind of drive behind it. This one, yeah, I don't know. Maybe because it's like the first, like, truly post-COVID book and post my COVID book. Like, there was just this sense that, like, I had particular, I don't know, critiques and ideas I wanted to inject into the discourse via poetry. Mm. And, like, it felt like it was hanging together more than either of the other two. There's this lit crit term. It was originally used about Don DeLillo's novels, called the systems novel. So a novel that really deals with, like, all the power structures that sort of influence people's lives. And in some ways, I think that, like, this book is almost systems poetry. Like, it's not, like, it's about me a bit, but it's also really about me in civilization or something.
Yeah, in this world. Did you have long COVID?
Yeah, like, it really, like, a good 6 months of my life were, like, very compromised in terms of what I was able to do. And it really makes you think about how you interface with, like, a capitalist society much more clearly. And no matter how many, like, chronically ill friends you have and how good an ally you think you are, until you sort of get some of these things firsthand, you just don't realize how, like, disposable you immediately seem once you're not, like, going out and
coping,
making,
and, yep,
spending money, especially spending money, being out and spending money in places. And it really just changes how you view a number of things. That's not the only thing that the book is doing. There are quite a few poems about warfare, it turns out, which I didn't necessarily think of, even though there's an entire section called Low Carbon Warfare. I wasn't like, this is a war book. But it's like an unignorable thing that I think actually a lot of poets do ignore.
Well, I'm impressed. That poem that you've just talked about is a collection of quotes.
Yeah, it's all quotes.
And, you know, you at the end obviously cite all the articles that you read to glean those quotes. And I'm overwhelmed at how much reading you must have done to pick those out.
I spent longer on it than you probably should spend on something like that.
Well, how did you survive that? That must have been a deep dive into something terrifying.
I'll just say something quickly about what the poem sort of does and riffs on. So there's this concept that a scholar named Duncan DePledge came up with, which is essentially an analysis of militaries basically are trying to greenwash their operations. So they actually kind of want to be low carbon because it may give them, like, a battlefield advantage. That's the only reason a military would want to do that. They don't care about ethics.
No.
But what they say, and, like, what the defense industrial complex says, is that, like, actually, we take this very seriously. We're, like, responsible, you know, global citizens. And it's ludicrous. And it's actually, like, that disconnect between the actual reasons and the stated reasons is, like, one of the clearest examples of sort of the hypocrisy of power that I've ever encountered. And because it's, like, about two of the sort of gravest issues that there could possibly be, climate change and, you know, slaughter.
Yeah, genocide, starvation.
So working on it, I mean, yeah, it was this journey into, like, really weird territory, like, you know, the corporate sustainability reports of, like, Northrop Grumman and, like, Lockheed Martin and stuff like that. But then also conflict scholarship and things like that. And, you know, it was interesting to stitch something like that together. I'd done sort of collage work before, but never where I feel like I had a point as good as this one. So it was interesting. I genuinely don't know how it reads as a piece. People say that it's interesting, but, like, it doesn't feel like anything else in the book. And that's
weird
to me, but it's also interesting to me. It's fun to do something as a writer that feels that different. I think you have to, actually.
Yeah, because you don't. There's no manipulating of the language that you would do. There's no kind of sly underhand stuff going on. The terrible,
editorially, I got to choose some things that were kind of me, but I didn't get to invent anything.
Yeah, it has a significant impact because you realise that people are thinking these things seriously and not seeing, as you say, the complete and utter hypocrisy of it all.
Yeah.
So it stands out in the book.
Yeah, and I am the sort of writer who has a tendency towards maybe self-parody if I'm not careful to do new things all the time. So, and there's also a piece in here called Bino, which is about the first ever heart transplant, which wasn't a heart taken from a human. It was taken from a chimpanzee named Bino. It's an animal rights piece, and it's like fairly clearly like a little essay rather than a poem. But it felt like it needed to be in a book of poems with the other sort of things that are plowing that same furrow. So, yeah, that was another thing that I feel like I did differently in this book. And luckily we're in a kind of like literary landscape where people kind of like hybrid books like that. Like, maybe people almost expect you to do things like that. But probably not the things I did this time.
Yeah, we ask a lot of our poets, don't we? We want to be entranced and amused and challenged and all those things. And we, for some reason, I think we expect poets to be pointing out the really important things that are going on in the world.
I hope so. I demand that of poets. And I feel like, if people aren't doing that, if it's like too... full of skeptical, navel-gazy, then you're doing something wrong. You're writing like it's the 90s still or something. Like, you can't really be doing the sort of, North American kind of like, I'm in my garden, but it's like quite kind of highbrow poetry that people did for decades and decades.
No, things are more immediate now. And do you think that's also because of the rise of performance poetry, that it gives people, you've got to get up there and say something and you can't be blathering on.
Undoubtedly. I think it's absolutely, and like I would say specifically, I have been influenced by other people's courage maybe, but just like confidence and thinking in terms of performance poetry. And I feel like I love doing gigs and like sharing things and getting feedback in that way. And I think I like give something back. And maybe I in turn have a bit of an influence on people, but like it definitely was more the other way at first because I was very pagey for years and years. Mm. And I became, I think, a much more worthwhile writer once I realized that like, boy, audiences matter, like whether they're readers or...
listeners.
Yeah, like it's... If you're not connecting with people on that level, you're really missing out on doing something important. And poetry's actually very good at that. Like, because, people don't do public novel readings.
No.
Very occasionally. I was once part of a 20... Like, I don't know. People read all of Moby Dick, which took a while, as you can imagine. So they were like... hundreds of writers who participated. But, that's the exception.
Yes, but it's not a normal thing to do. And poetry, it's got to, nowadays, I think we demand that it works on the page as well as being spoken, even if a poet is not necessary. That's why I like having people read their poems on this program, because there's nothing like hearing the actual poet reading the poem and giving it the inflection and the life that is come from their creation of that particular poem.
Yeah, I do get a fair bit of the time people telling me that they read my own work in my voice, like because it's, I guess, relatively distinctive or recognisable or...
Yeah, you're not quite the Sam Hunt of the poetry world, but yes, there's a definite Eric Kennedy voice.
No, not quite. Oh, well.
Well, I don't know whether you would how you would feel to be the Sam Hunt of the poetry world.
I think there's already a Sam Hunt of the poetry world.
Yes, I agree.
I think he can have that one.
Yes, exactly. You're the Eric Kennedy of
poetry. I'm happy with that. That'll work.
Is humour an antidote, or is it essential? I mean, not, you know, writing about the kind of topics that you write about could take you down rather than elevate you. So humour is there at your bidding, I guess.
It's inextricable from everything for me. There's really nothing so terrible that there isn't something funny about it, which is an uncomfortable thing to actually deal with sometimes. But, like, I think that it shows a respect for reality to be funny. You don't have to, like, try to be funny necessarily, but, like, you need to be able to see that there is something ridiculous in the incongruity of things. Because, I mean, humor is often just the incongruous.
Yes.
For me, I think it honors how things are to have poems that are funny. Also, like, you know, people do like to laugh. And, like, as much as, like, I think there is more poetry that is funny now, like, there is still a sort of, like, po-facedness occasionally that, like, I think it's still worth, like, pushing back against a little bit. Like, because of all the writers that there are, poets are the most, like, self-serious sometimes. That, like, we feel we're doing this, like, mortal work, this, like, honorable calling we have compels us to write in this way for, like, not that many readers, if we're honest. And, like, no, but, like, I think it's worth remembering that, like, we're actually just, like, quite ordinary. Being funny is part of that, I think.
Yes, as you pointed out in that poem, we are animals and we have all those attributes in taking life. Well, you do need from time to time to take time out from taking life too seriously. It's essential for our well-being. You know, in the middle of your poem about Gaza, you talk about people who don't see, you know, what's going on there as having hearts like refrigerated beetroots. Yeah. And that image just kind of knocked me sideways because it's so funny for no particular reason.
It's the second sort of in the piece Bino, you know, there's quite a lot about hearts in there. And it's like actually like it's clearly like the most heart-like vegetable when you think about it. So I don't know. It's just.
And but a refrigerated beetroot. I mean, that's another level up from just having a heart like a beetroot.
Yeah, the thing is, I actually don't have a great. I'm glad you haven't been like, where do you get your ideas?
No.
Because like, I genuinely like, quite a lot of it's just luck and one's unique neurochemistry, and it's like hard to. Translate that into like a reason.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're just like, yeah, that's definitely what I'm saying.
Yes. Yeah.
which is part of the fun of actually doing something like poetry, where you get to be that sort of daft, is like discovering what you're going to say. And like, you know, I don't know I'm going to write a line about a heart being like a refrigerated beetroot, but then it's there and I'm like, yeah, I'm glad I did that.
That's a good
one. That was worth doing.
Yeah. Now, before you read your last poem, let's just talk about Word, which is imminent,
yeah.
And you're going to be on the famous Ray Shipley's Late Night Poetry Hour, which is Friday the 29th of August at 9 o'clock at night at Little Andromeda. And tell me who else is going to be on the lineup with you.
Kate Camp, whom I've read with once before. Gabriel Huria, who has a new book out with Canterbury University Press called Pakiaka, which I worked on, so I can vouch for its quality, and the Australian poet Dominic Guerrera, whom I have not read a lot of, but am reading now, and that's exciting. And it's cool to have, you know, an overseas feature at Ray Shipley's Late Night Poetry Hour, which is, at the risk of horrifying people that I work with on, like, another reading series that I co-organize, Ray Shipley's Late Night Poetry Hour is possibly my favorite, like, poetry gig series in Otatahi. Like, it's just...
Oh, it's
it always has, like,
legendary,
the atmosphere that you want. Like, there's no other reading series that has that particular kind of, like, raucous joyousness to it, which Ray, of course, fosters in their own unique way.
Let's have your last poem, Eric.
Great. This is the final piece in the book. The book opens and closes with sort of illness poems, and this is one of them. So this is Self-Affirming Mantra. I was searching my symptoms online. Disturbed sleep led to fatigue, which led to post-viral condition, and also to alcohol abuse and liver disease and unthinkable cancers, which all led to conclusions about society and how one operates in it. How someone can be rational and maladaptive at the same time. How resilience is just a word in a PowerPoint. How years of work go into the manufacture of one unit of anxiety, a person. And how each unit, although similar to others in many ways, is unique. The product of a freakish and golden permutation of inputs. Which led me back to my usual searches for wars and politicians and racing drivers and recipes and animals and islands and colors. I went out into the day with my symptoms. The sun made the swans look like harps. I appreciated the silhouettes of buildings. I scrumped apples from over a fence. My symptoms were still with me, but also not with me. I was loving them. I was setting them free.
Eric Kennedy reading from his new collection called Sick Power Trip, which is published by Te Herenga Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
What my mother said to the gunman in the vegetable aisle at Pack and Save. Since my mother no longer rode her bike over the big railway bridge, her scarf coming loose in the billowing smoke, and since she no longer got to Funky Pumpkin, running her hands over the big bins of Coomera, since she was in fact at Pack and Save on a Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m, eyeing up the cauliflower heads, while a gunman in a black balaclava told everyone to get down on the floor, since her hips were sore and the floor a long way down, and since the gunman looked familiar, since his red-rimmed eyes looked frantic, since his hand was shaking and the gun was waving like something in a movie, she faced him. "Son," she began. And since a cop who'd been previously fondling an orange in the next aisle was already cocking his trigger, things happened pretty quickly. Shots ringing out and the gunman falling and a pink-haired girl rising from the floor to pull my mother aside. And since the gunman is now in a wheelchair and my mother no longer remembers that terrible day, no one will ever really know what she was about to say to the gunman that Tuesday in the vegetable aisle at Pack and Save.
That was Frankie McMillan reading from her latest collection of stories, Eddie Sparkle's Bridal Taxi. Frankie is very well known internationally and nationally as someone who absolutely knows how to write short fiction in all its forms. She's won many prizes and been published widely for the stories. This is the fourth book from Canterbury University Press, and it's full of your characteristic quirkiness. I hate saying that word, Frankie, because quirky just kind of doesn't really sum it up. Apparently I said there was something called the Frankieverse, and I hope it was me that said it, because you have a cast of characters who inhabit a world that is just such a delight to visit. Tell me about that story, because you said there are craft things in there that are worthy of chatting about.
Okay, well, like a lot of my stories, there's always a grain of truth, and that little element of truth, it grounds me. So then I feel confident about going on and fictionalising the story. And the story is really about random events that happen. So somebody in the supermarket aisle eyeing up the cauliflower heads, and suddenly there's a gunman ahead of them. When I was crafting this piece, I wasn't, first of all, conscious that I was crafting. I just wanted to get the story out. And when I'm writing, I often tend to use this one long, breathless sentence. And I think it matches the emotional urgency of the subject material as well. It also allows me to sort of get it all out in the one sitting. So I tend to write very quickly and in the one sitting. I've borrowed some poetic elements in this piece. You'll notice that there's a recurring word, since my mother no longer rode her bike, since her scarf. And this since sort of links the story with that recurring word.
And it builds and builds and builds, doesn't it? Because you're dropping another clause or whatever grammatical term it is, you know, which has since this. And you know it's going to build to a crescendo. And then it's wonderful because nobody knew what she was going to say.
Yes. in this piece too, Maureen, I'm also dealing with time about, like, there's a reference at the start that since my mother no longer rode her bike, so we get a picture of a woman who used to ride her bike over the railway bridge, and by the end of the story, she can no longer remember the events of that day. And the same with the gunman. At one time he was, you know, waving the gun. Now he's in a wheelchair. So it's one of the reasons why I like the short form. You can have almost a whole history of somebody in a very short space.
I've been very vague about what it's called, this short form, because, you know, as you know, there's so many different categories, sub-genres of the form. And I don't think you sit down and think, oh, I'm writing flash or I'm writing micro or I'm writing, you know, short, whatever. I guess you probably write the story and take as long as you think the story needs.
Yes, and after a while, it's sort of an instinct, you know, when you're coming to the end of a story. But just to get back to the word thing, flash is more of an American term, short, more of a European term. With a longer history. A lot of 20th century writers write in the short form, Kafka, Gertrude Stein, Hemingway. And here in New Zealand, Janet Frame wrote a couple of pieces in the short form. Notes to the Russian War is really worth looking at.
You teach it as well.
So yeah,
it's
I do.
Not just...
I can't get away from it.
No. And your classes are, you know, very popular. And you've taught some wonderful writers of who've gone on to have fame as well with their writing of short fiction or micro or flash / whatever.
Yeah, well, it's very satisfying to see people who haven't had much writing experience and you introduce them to this form. And it seems like a manageable form because it's so short and you can try out a number of different stories in an afternoon. And no big deal if they don't work because you've got another afternoon. Whereas if you're embarking on a novel, that's a huge investment of time. and even a short story. You know, a conventional short story of 5,000 words, that would take me 3 or 4 weeks to do. So it's a good way for writers to learn their craft, and they learn a lot about word economy when they're writing flash, because each word has to count. They also learn that you can't have too many adjectives and adverbs in the writing. And there's a strong focus on the one point, which is very good for beginner writers to learn rather than meandering off in all sorts of different directions.
You say you wrote that one quickly and possibly do write these things quickly, but then do you go back over and really hone it down?
Yeah, I get what I call the guts of it out. and then sometimes I'll get a bit obsessive and I'll just stay there tinkering until I've got it. But sometimes I'll go back a day or two later and sharpen it up. Generally, though, within a week I have it. But I have heard of some writers of the short form that go back years later and they're still tinkering with it and still looking at the structure and a bit like poetry, I suppose. Mm. That poets tend to do that too.
I know.
Yeah.
It's never finished till it's finished, and then when is it finished?
You spend all morning putting in a comma and all afternoon taking it out.
When you put a collection like this together, are you often surprised at how there are not necessarily themes but links that you weren't aware of that suddenly when you put the body of work together you think, gosh, a lot of horses in here, a lot of birds.
Yeah, I do.
Where did that zebra come from?
I do. It's not until it's all in a collection, though, that I can see that. And I can see that, there's an awful lot of animals in here. And I was thinking about that this morning and thinking that the first stories that were read to me had animals in them, Brewer Rabbit, Brewer Fox, Winnie the Pooh, and also like a lot of baby boomers, I had religious instruction at school and we had these wonderful stories about Noah and the Ark, Jonah and the whale. And, you know, they're pretty unsophisticated, but they still have lodged in me somewhere. I've also, just getting back to the animal thing, I've worked with animals and spent a year milking cows. There's a poem in here about milking a cow. Other things that keep on cropping up in my work of family relationships.
Yes, this aunts. The mad aunts, groups of aunts. They're usually in a group, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's how I see them. In my childhood, always in a sort of a gang.
Yeah, a gang of aunts.
Yeah.
The other person who's turned up here again from some of your other work is Mr. Whippy.
Oh, where did he come in?
In the one about, I was reading it this morning.
Joe Fish, yes. Yes.
And I thought, gosh, there's Mr. Whippy again.
Yes. Oh, well, he's elbowed his way into the collection.
Fish too. I mean, I know they're sort of animals, but there's a different breed of animal when you look at fish. But, you know, in every work it's this humour, and as I was saying before, the humour has so many different levels to it, doesn't it? It can surprise you because it's so unexpected, where you put people and where you put animals and how stories begin and end.
Yeah, and it's not a conscious thing. I think it's just the way I think.
It is. That's what I mean when there is a Frankie verse.
Yeah.
It's you're never going to see conventional things happening in your stories.
Right, yeah. And people say that they're surreal, and that surprises me too because...
Do you think that they're pretty much grounded in reality, in fact?
Yeah, I do. well, for instance, the Jesus story, I mean, I'm not a Christian, but I know that some Christians do see religious figures, so that doesn't seem to me to be surreal. The angel in the probation officer and the angel, that comes from a painting by a Finnish symbolist painter, Hugo Simberg, called The Wounded Angel. And it's quite a famous painting. And I remember staring at it one day and thinking, God, what goes on there? There was this wounded angel being carried by these two boys on a stretcher. So that's how that story came about. And I suppose it might seem surreal to people, but when you know the backstory, it's a piece of ekphrastic, what we call ekphrastic writing.
So there's always experimentation going on in your work, isn't there?
And the short form allows it. I think some experimentation, if it continued, it could get a bit tedious. I mean, in the short piece, Jack Fu's, past Jack Fu's shop, A Faux Pantoum, I think if I'd continued with those repeating phrases that I used there, that, it just might have been a bit heavy-handed. But in a very short piece, you can get away with that. And you can also get away with sort of making political statements that might seem a bit didactic or a bit heavy if it went on for longer. But you can get in and get out. And that's another reason why I quite like the form.
Yeah. Do you get delight? You know, do you finish something and feel that sort of joy or delight that a reader would?
I feel it when I'm writing it. I feel my most wholesome when I'm writing. And sometimes I'll laugh out loud. but, yeah, I do. I get an enormous amount of pleasure out of writing these short pieces.
And, they're very visual too, aren't they? They require people to get their imaginations going. I know that probably is in most writing. You, as a reader, you have to imagine yourself into the story. But yours in particular, I think, really strikes sparks because you have to see these sometimes quite crazy things going on. And that, as I say, can really spark joy in the reader because you've been taken to places that you would never expect to have been taken.
Right, and I think that's partly to do with the form too, that you get taken to the heart of the matter very quickly. So often these pieces have a bit of an emotional wallop to them because you are taken to the heart so quickly, and there is this emphasis sort of on the one thing, often circling the one thing.
You're going to read us another piece to end, Frankie.
It's the poem Emily Dickinson's Black Cake. And I'll just say that Emily Dickinson was a famous 19th century poet, and in her time she was more known for her baking than her poetry.
And can I just say there was the most delicious fruitcake at your launch?
Oh, God. Well, I bake a lot of fruitcakes. And I'd always wanted to say that when people asked for the recipe, it comes from my great-great-grandmother. It's a very old recipe. And so this poem is about that. Emily Dickinson's Black Cake. I would like to say my dark fruitcake comes from a recipe handed down from my nanny, who in turn got it from her nanny, whose mother happened to be Emily Dickinson's maid, and not from the Edmonds cookbook, the one everyone has with the building on the cover and the sure to rise slogan over the top, and the awful memory of a man I once kissed, solely because he said he was Mr. Edmonds' grandson and possibly an heir to a vast fortune from tins of baking powder. I would like to say the dark fruitcake I make lasts until Christmas, but it never lasts more than 2 weeks because my husband and all his relatives are wolves. Lastly, I would like to say because the food mix is broken, I beat by hand. half crouched with the effort, just like my nanny did, bending over the bowl, pennies stained with brandy, something feral rising in her eye.
Frankie McMillan, reading from this amazing collection, wonderful collection of short fiction entitled Eddie Sparkle's Bridal Taxi and published by Canterbury University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
My father gives birth. I think about you in labour that night, birthing yourself out of this world, your pains coming faster and faster, your groans and your bearing down. My stepsister running round the hospital in the middle of the night in Apia, looking for someone who would give you some relief. But I knew somehow that there was no epidural for this. So I accepted that the nurses wouldn't allow morphine without sign-off, and there was only one doctor on duty, and no one could find him. There was a point when you stopped groaning for a while, and even though you couldn't speak, we knew to raise you to sitting, and you looked up into the var beyond the hospital ceiling, and your mouth opened, your eyes widened as if you were trying to take more of the sight in, and your face transfigured from the inside out. I said, "Who can you see, Dad?" Because although I couldn't see them, I could see in your face your tupuanga had come for you, your ancestors had come for you, and I had cleared the end of your bed earlier so you could leave unencumbered. But even though they were there to take you home, you have always taken your own sweet time. So you didn't leave right then. The transfiguration faded, and you hung on and hunkered and howled like uterus, the goddess of birth, the entrance also to death. Later, when it was quiet, and my stepsister and Tama were outside having a smoke, and I had fallen asleep on your shoulder, that's when you decided to fly off over the end of the bed, off the end of the furthest tip of Savai, underneath the waves, into the mouth of Pulotu. When I woke to find you gone, I stayed there with you, holding those still warm minutes to me, when it was just you and me, the just-born you, like you held the just-born me 50 years earlier in another hospital. I would like it if you lived inside my body, but you come and go. Perhaps there is much boat building to do there in Pulotu. Or perhaps you are too big to fit inside the cage of my frame. Or perhaps you are like the frigate bird carved into the outside of my hand, flying back and forth between this world and that.
That was Tusiata Avia, reading from her latest collection of poems, Giving Birth to My Father. Tusiata has written many volumes of poetry. She has won many awards. She has been appointed a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit. I'll just say that again. She has been appointed a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to poetry and the arts. She received a Distinguished Alumni Award at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, and in 2024 she received a Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement.
Tusiata, it's a huge privilege, isn't it, to be there when a person dies?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, particularly when it's somebody that you're so close to. Yeah.
And this book,
I was just going to say, I think that was one of the most important times for me on looking back, you know. It was a really kind of healing experience, actually, although I didn't know that until kind of later.
No, often you don't, but it's profound. And to have them with you at that stage of their leaving, you know, it's hard to describe, but that is the beauty of a good writer. A great writer is to be able to capture that moment, so that it not only is it there for you as the writer, but it's there for the reader as well to bring back their own memories.
Yeah, one of the things that I found at the launch is that a number of people said to me that, you know, that they had lost a parent, and that it, you know, it spoke to their experience in one way or another, which is always really lovely to hear. You know, I always really appreciate hearing from, you know, readers or listeners how they're affected. Yeah.
Yeah, difficult. You say that this has been a very difficult collection of poems to put together, and it has been some time since your father died, so I guess you have been living with these poems for some time.
Yeah, it's been 9 years, actually, since he passed, and I started writing those poems pretty quickly afterwards. You know, they were, for me, a way of kind of making sense of what had happened, of it was part of my grief process. It was also, you know, kind of the only way that I had to deal with some of the really awful stuff that happened with my family during and after the funeral.
Yeah. Well, that comes through because, you know, as much as it's, you know, an extraordinary experience, the death, any death like that, but, you know, it doesn't always bring peace and light, does it? And understanding.
No. I was thinking the other day, actually, that I've always had nightmares about my father dying way before he died. For years and years before he died, I would have these nightmares that he had died, and I would be absolutely beside myself in these nightmares. But it was almost as if I was grieving him before he died. And maybe that was important because the family experience was so bad, I had to, I couldn't do any of that at the time, you know.
Mm. Yeah. And your life with your father, you know, he'd come and been in your life for, you know, for big periods of it, but then he'd left and gone and come and gone and had moved back to Samoa. So, you had
lost him in different ways over the years, hadn't you?
Yeah, that's right. It was always a bit of a coming and going experience, really, because as I was growing up, he went back to Samoa a lot because, you know, he was the eldest in the family, so he was constantly having to go back and build houses and establish businesses and, you know, plantations and a bus business and a shop and all that kind of stuff. So his life really worked around, really revolved around looking after the family. That's why he came to New Zealand in 1952 in the first place.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's wonderful memories, especially of the fishing in the Waimakariri, of the salmon that you put in, you know, preserved, that were preserved in all those bottles, looking out at you.
he was such a talented man in many different areas, musically, sporting, great fisherman, hunter, really creative, even was in the Toastmasters, which was quite extraordinary because, you know, he finished school at what would have been the end of, you know, before high school.
Yes, yes.
So he didn't have an opportunity to have a secondary education, and you know his second language was English. So, yeah, I don't know how he managed to do Toastmasters in Christchurch in the 1970s.
Well, he obviously impressed people, and he took himself off. He had the confidence to do that, the encouragement.
He really did.
So these poems cover, you know, his life, his death, but it's also you sort of situating yourself between these two places, Samoa and Aotearoa.
Yeah. I mean, one of the big the scariest aspect of this book is the fact that I'm really doing a critique of Samoan funeral culture.
Mm.
And that is not an easy thing to put out into public. And while there are some really beautiful things about Samoan funeral culture, and indeed, the intention of funeral culture is a really beautiful one, but it often becomes really warped, and it can just become a vehicle for people's egos and a massive financial drain on families.
Mm.
It's something that a lot of Samoans, you know, make jokes about because we, you know, Samoans have such a gallows humour. But, yeah, it's I think being right in the thick of it like that, I did come home and kind of critique that kind of culture-wide, I would say. Culture of, like, funeral culture, yeah.
So what's scarier, David Seymour or having to front up to
Definitely my family, by a long shot.
Yeah, I bet. It's, you can keep that far away from, but your family's in your face, aren't they?
That's right. So And in fact, my daughter and I are going to Samoa in a couple of weeks for the first time. Well, we'll be seeing my family for the first time since he died.
Gosh.
So, yeah. Quite nervous about that.
Oh, I'm sure you are. But, you know, you've had this amount of time to think carefully about what you have to say, and I'm sure you will stand up for what you
said. I think I know how to look after myself better now than I did then because, I really couldn't look after myself then because I was, you know, in the middle of grief and a lot of other things too.
Yeah, it's a very, it's almost impossible time to confront something like that really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just to finish, you are going to be writer in residence next year at IIML.
At IIML, yeah. And currently looking for a place to live in Wellington. So, which I will be going back to flatting, which I haven't done for many, many years. So, yeah, still looking for a place to live. So if anyone knows of a good place to live.
Okay, get in touch with Tusiata. Well, we will
put that ad out there.
Yeah, we will miss your presence down here, but I can imagine you're just going to flourish up there.
Yeah, it should be fun. I'm not looking forward to the hills.
Gosh, no. Yeah.
Because I'm on crutches, but, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be great.
Wonderful. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.